Thanks for listening to The Gist. If you want to check out an ad-free version and bonus content, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. It is the best way to directly support our endeavors. It's Wednesday, June 28th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Headline in Business Insider, giant food president says thieves are stealing everything. From shrimp to deodorant, and warned some grocery stores could close. I could see why, after stealing the shrimp, you'd need something to throw the police off your scent. But in all God's honest truth, this is serious. This really is. This is happening everywhere. You've read about it, no doubt. We have the CEO of Giant telling local media, quote, "What we must always do is ensure we can run our stores safely and profitably. If we can't do both those things, I'll have no choice but to close a store." This clearly takes a toll. You've definitely heard about the trend. The people in the Washington, D.C. area watching WUSA Channel 9 did not want their Giant grocery stores to close, but I noted this portion of the report about the retail thefts at Giant.
Inside the store, there's a sign up letting customers know there have been several changes due to significant increase in crime and theft. Now, among those changes, self-checkout is now limited to 20 items or less.
That self-scanner bit, I heard reference to that in other coverage too. Retail theft and losses, and also self-scanners. Well, self-scanners aren't people stealing from the retailer. It's sort of the retailer stealing from would-be employees who could be earning the paycheck that a robot is not earning, but has been eating up. Self-scanners are an unasked-for agreement where the retailer conscripts the consumer to do a job it once did. Now, I gotta say, personally, I have a rule of three at the checkout. Scan it once, really hope it goes through. Scan it again, still hoping it works. Scan it a third time, assiduously check to see I'm following the rules. Check to see I've put the GD purchases in the ever-loving purchase area. See that the weight checks out. Make sure the barcode is legible. But really, how much do you ask of my indentured servitude? I'm sorry about your shrimp shrinkage, but I'm a bit at my wit's end here. I'm not saying I steal items when self-scanning, but if an honest person in my exact situation, and perhaps you've been there, if that person were to be pushed to the limits, I could understand that person saying, how much time and attention do I have to put in getting the beep to register in the right way rather than a dishonest beep, which it seems to be telling me. Much like your deodorant, sirs, I am at a loss over the question of how much work I need to do in order to pay you. And also, Giant, you're out of shrimp again. On the show today, I go from local retail news to not just national or international news, but a planetary development. The Earth is off by 31.5 inches. Does this warrant 2.5 feet of panic or 2,100 gigatons of caution? But first, we're joined once more by Lee Berger. The paleoanthropologist discovered Homo naledi in the system of caves in South Africa. Now, I say he discovered this early human or hominin. He hired slim researchers to fit into the crevasse which led to Homo naledi's lair. But he knew that he had to see the site for himself. And so the ever-expansive, yet recently shrunken, Lee Berger is up next to tell us about the lengths he went to and the widths he retreated from.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's you know.
Trying to get him out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
We're joined once more by paleoanthropologist Lee Berger, National Geographic explorer in residence and the leader of the team that discovered Homo naledi. This was a significant discovery. It was Berger's second really big discovery because Homo naledi engage in behaviors that we previously thought of as our own. One was symbol making, the other burial or bone caching. But some other experts have expressed skepticism. The New York Times quoted an archaeologist, Paul Pettit of Durham University, saying, you know, it's possible the bodies may have just washed in. They weren't really buried that way. So I asked Berger about the understandable tendency as the discoverer of this entire species, as the person bringing them to the world's attention, who wants to see in them the most advancement you can. I asked him if the evidence was truly there. Are you sure the bones and symbols mean what you say they mean?
So thank you for asking that question. So I want to start with one thing, and there is a tendency in media that is sort of a natural human tendency. But even the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal are saying, you know, Lee Berger says there were 30 plus scientists on this paper. Mm-hmm. So I want to start with that. So you're quoting one or two or three scientists against 30 of some of the most experienced scientists in the world in this field who are all concluding this. And it's being based upon evidence. I would say my quick answer to Paul Pettit in that is, and I'll give you an interesting anecdote here, but my first answer is read the paper. We actually show in page after page that there is no evidence that material has washed in there. What we show very clearly, and by the way, we were actually addressing a recent paper by Paul that said, what would the standards need to be to meet burial?
Mm-hmm.
And we met them. He just then raised the standards again, which is a human thing to do. But what we have in that case, let me lay it out in the elevator speech. We have a floor that has almost no stratigraphy in it, except for a one stratigraphic line, an orange red clay line about 5 centimeters down that has been interrupted. So something has dug a hole and broken that line, that sedimentary layer up. It has taken that dirt out of that hole. A body has been put in a fetal position, one or more bodies in some cases, into a fetal position while they had flesh on there. We give all the data and evidence for this in these papers. Then that body is recovered by the dirt that came from that hole with fragments of that interrupted line that we call the lorm, the layer of orange-red mud. And then those bodies decay, leaving gaps and space, but physically occupy that whole space, showing that they were covered by that dirt. The holes that they're in are broadly oval in shape, accommodating those bodies within it. By every standard that Paul Pettit, that you just quoted there, has mm-hmm. ever said, that is a grave. Now, I do get there are some critics who say, well, since only humans bury, then it can't be a grave. But then, it is a hole dug into the ground with a Homo naledi body in it that has been covered by the same dirt.
Yeah. And, you know, by the way, you're answering a question that I raised on the show, which is, I think it was maybe misstated that only humans bury or even grieve their dead. You know, as you know, some elephants have been found to cover bodies with soil.
That's right.
And branches. They grieve chimpanzees. They even found stories of cats burying
Absolutely.
Their dead. But the detail that you're laying out and the care and attention is heretofore thought to be specific to humans.
It is. Those are remarkable instances you're referring to. This is a human level mm-hmm. of interaction. Mm-hmm. Those approach the crudest level of a human interaction that we have. You know, and some people would argue, by the way, that a mother carrying a dead baby around for several days is the opposite of the recognition of death and mourning, because it doesn't recognize death.
And
it
what
may
about
be mourning, but it's not recognizing death.
And to make another comparison to animals, you know, as you know, chimpanzees are sometimes given a paintbrush, and they can make patterns, and the patterns sometimes could resemble something like a crosshatch. So what is the art that you found? Why are you saying that that is more human than what I've just described?
Right. So there's a couple of things here. One is that, and first I have to be careful, I'm not allowed by my colleagues to use the word art. Art has a very human meaning to it, but let's call them symbols and maybe even meaning-making symbols. Here's why. There are two parts to it. One, a simple answer to yours is that the chimpanzee did not invent the paintbrush, and it was handed to them by a human and given the medium to do it. In that, and often mimicking a human as an example. So that, but I'm not going to dig too deep in that, because I think the general idea of what you're pointing to is right. These are firstly repeated symbols. They're not just this one symbol randomly done in the way a bear scratches a tree you could get randomly. They are repeated symbols. They are crosses that are made, upside down crosses. There's a fish-shaped type thing, and that's probably what we want to see. In that area, there are equal signs that are repeated that are clearly the same symbol done over. There are triangles. And now triangles are really important, by the way. I showed them to a physicist at Carnegie Institute, where I'm also a Carnegie Fellow. And the first thing they said when they saw that symbol was they knew math. And I said, why do you say that? And they said, well, because the triangle is a very rare form in nature. It occurs in some rare crystal forms and that sort of thing. But it means that you have an understanding of the equilateral distances between spaces. And, you know, I don't know whether that's true. Really, we haven't had to ask that question before. But there are powerful shapes that are non-random and repeated across these boards. And then, by the way, did we add they put something on top of them? You know, they took a non-native substance to that immediate moment and covered them in that. And you may have seen some of those images. They're quite striking. And they erased older ones with dirt from the floor. So they smeared them on and then started their own, leaving these things. So, you know, I think whatever – and one of the things – what has been interesting, by the way, in the commentary – and let's go back to criticism, because that's important and healthy, and critique in a process like this, because this is a profound thing that we're hypothesizing here. They're doing this into a rock that is half as hard as a diamond, or almost so. That takes effort and intent.
Mm-hmm.
So we argue that these are symbols and that they definitely have meaning. Interestingly, there's been almost no scientists I've seen – you may have seen this, but I have not picked that up yet – saying they aren't symbols. They are not really carved, meaning-making symbols. The one throwaway, which, you know, I kind of find amusing, I'll explain why, is because humans must have made them.
Yeah.
Homo sapiens made them. And I find that an astounding leap, given this situation, because Homo sapiens in sub-Saharan Africa, in fact, in most places around the planet, don't go into deep cave spaces with any frequency.
Yeah.
And they leave evidence behind when they do.
Yeah.
And that there is no evidence of any other humans other than the 47 approximate people that have entered that space that we know of, that had been in that space. All the evidence is Homo naledi manipulation, yet humans, in our arrogance to maintain human exceptionalism, say, oh, well, I don't care. The evidence that humans are there are the symbols themselves.
So no humans except the 47 have ever gotten into that space. You're one of the 47, right?
I am.
Let's talk a little bit about that process. What was your height and weight when this all started?
So I'm just under 6'2". Mm-hmm. So by far the tallest person who ever made that attempt into there. And before attempting that, I was I was 125 kilograms. I don't know what that is in pounds.
275 pounds?
Yeah, a lot.
You were what we would call a big guy.
I was big guy.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was out of the question that you would get in there.
Yeah. And then I was turning 58 last year and realized there were all the, we had this burial paper in play and we were about to publish it. And I realized that there were these unanswered questions. There were these contradictions in our data. I was trained as a geologist. I've been working in these systems and only three geologists had ever been able to get into that space. Mm-hmm. And the explorers and geologists who got in, you know, the vast majority of PhDs had never couldn't sort these problems. And they're little minor problems to someone who deals with, but they're exactly the ones that we deal with in the critiques that, you know, you're talking about, you know, which direction are things flowing? What angles are there? Is the dirt originating from one source or another? Could they have been washed in there? Are there fluvial events? And so I decided that I was going to make an attempt. And so I spent 6 months losing weight, lost 55 pounds.
Yeah.
And got in.
How'd you do it? What were your methods of weight loss?
And why do people always ask that?
I don't know. I just wondered if you said, that's it, I'm only going on Slim Fast, or if you said
You know, I did this wonderful scientific calculation that you, if as long as you eat less than you burn, then you lose weight.
Exactly. But it's funny, like in the history of weight loss, like I can't think of too many other people whose goal weight is to fit in the parameters of an existing geological structure. Because the thing is, as I don't need to tell you, Lee, if you're 6'2 and 220, that's still hard to get into the crevice as you described it.
Yeah, no, it was terrible. It was the most exciting and worst moments of my life. And on the way down, I had to make a decision in three places on, you know, do I push, because my chest, you know, one of the parts that is compressible, but it's not comfortable, was jammed in certain spaces. My hips were barely passing through, my bony parts of my hips. There are spaces, and got to remember, this is not, I want to clearly picture this for your audience. This is not a pipe. It's not a 45 foot pipe. It is a series of crevasses and slots that you move almost 25 feet laterally as you're moving that 45 feet down. And that lateral is not a straight line. So your feet may be going one direction, your pelvis is going another in a slot, your chest and upper body tilted, and your head turned sideways to fit through the one above. And it is that every centimeter of the way down. It is horrendous. There are many places where one arm must be extended above your head, one arm below you, squeezed against your chest to fit through the space below. And that's with gravity. Going up, 10 times as bad.
Oh. So what's the most stuck you ever got?
I almost died on the way out.
Yeah. How do you practice for that? I assume they have cameras, right? Do you get any sense of here's where the turns are? It's mapped, isn't it, to some extent?
It's not mapped because we couldn't get – that was part of the problem. We couldn't get any mapping instruments into a space that would map in that side of space. So it was loosely laid out, and that's why our early pictures show it as a kind of chimney. And gave a lot of false impressions. Mm-hmm. You know, I spend a great deal of time in spaces. I've never been in an extreme space like this. I've been stuck before, but mm-hmm. I've never been in a space this extreme. And, you know, because to enter a space like this, you have to make a decision that you may lose your life.
Yeah. Of all the things you've told me, can you specifically point to one thing that you wouldn't have been able to tell me if you hadn't gone down there?
Yep. That there were symbols on the wall.
You found the symbols?
I found them.
Wow.
45 or so people had gone in front of me and missed them. They were right next to the hallway between the Hill antechamber burial and the Dinaletti chamber.
So of the two great, I mean, you found a species, you found a burial or caching, but symbols are the other major find of this discovery.
I think so. I think they are going to be probably one, although I think we have more coming, one of the great discoveries of this. But I think that this will unleash a age of discovering greater recognition of greater complexity in ancient human relatives in the past.
So other than the fact that you saw the symbols and others didn't or couldn't recognize them, you know, there's an analogy between people who lead an expedition but aren't the actual people on the planet. And in fact, it's called to mind by your cave explorers would call themselves underground astronauts. So they're at mission control. A guy named Gene Kranz is directing the mission that we know Neil Armstrong for. We don't think that Gene Kranz knows less. It might be I'm sure Gene Kranz never even said to himself, I could be an astronaut. But you would have been in that position. Had you have been always at a remove, knowing what you know, still directing the mission, would a part of you to this day be regretful?
Of course. You know, I said, and, you know, anyone who's watched my lectures or seen me on television, I always used to joke about, you know, I'll never go down in that system. My ego is too large to get down in that system, you know. But that's also a way of coping. You know, you're sitting there staring at a space that has been incredibly meaningful to your life individually. It is a great, no matter what you make of Homo naledi, it is a great scientific discovery. It's an extraordinary space. It is likely their version of Tutankhamun's tomb. And it's an extraordinary space. And of course I wanted to be there. I would couch that with, well, you know, we can send people with that are competent, that can fit, that can make it. But, you know, and I'm incredibly glad that I made that attempt because it was, you know, those symbols were there. And you know, I was there for a different mission though. And let me defend, because I guarantee you there's someone listening that'll go, what, why didn't the others see that? You know, what were they? And no, that's my fault as the team leader. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is an extraordinarily dangerous environment. This is a terrible place to get into. You are risking your life, no matter how thin you are, how small you are, to get in there. We coach people from day one of the danger. We warn them that if they get injured in there seriously, they are going to stay in there. They may never get out. We were going to send doctors in there to stay with them till they could get themselves out. That's how bad it is. You are mission focused. You're there to do a job. Your time is limited when you're in there. Down you go. You get to that job. And by the time the second person has gone through there, people stop looking. Backyard syndrome. People quit looking around. Why? Because all the good stuff must have been found. Even if they see it, their mind protects them from that and says, that's got to be nothing because someone else would have seen it if it's something. And so, you know, I was there to see things that hadn't been seen. So I was prepped for that moment. And when I saw this passage, you'll hear me on the narration, you know, I go, wow, it's smaller than I thought, but it looks remarkably like a doorway. And then you hear me pause, and then I look to the left of the door because I'm an archaeologist. What do you do when you look at a doorway? You look for signs. You look for meaning-making symbols that humans are great at putting on doorways. And guess what was right to the left of the door? All these symbols were right there. And by the way, you don't believe me, you'll get to watch it. July 17th, the Netflix premiere Cave of Bones airs, and there was a cameraman with me.
Lee Berger is a paleoanthropologist and National Geographic explorer in residence who led the team which discovered Homo naledi. Lee, thanks so much.
Oh, what a pleasure. Love to talk to you again. As we get more discoveries, we can continue the conversation.
And now the spiel. CNN headline, humans pump so much groundwater that Earth's axis has shifted, study finds. Indeed, this study was published on June 15th in the Journal of Geophysical Research Letters. My dearest Lorraine, as I gaze upon this draw, by which I mean a terrain feature formed by two parallel ridges or spurs with low ground between them, I think of your inviting arms. Oh, my dearest Horace, as I read your last missive, I could almost picture the draw, or what I refer to as a arroyo, ravine, or gulch, especially one with a broad floor and gently sloping sides that exists in my longing heart. Anyway, according to the study in the Geophysical Research Letters, moving all that water around and sucking it up from the earth has shifted the earth's tilt 31.5 inches eastward, which is a lot, or maybe a little, or something to worry about, or something that just happens. We just didn't know how much until now. It definitely is a thing that happens. But the authors of the paper, or more precisely, those covering it in the popular press, know they have a gap or an arroyo of meaning between the scientists and the public. So they offer up some helpful, they say, ways to contextualize the amount of water we pump. The claim is between 1993 and 2010, which was the period examined by the study, humans extracted more than 2,150 gigatons of groundwater from inside the Earth. To put that in perspective, this is how they put it in perspective. If that amount were poured into the ocean, it would raise global sea levels by about 0.24 inches, which they helpfully tell us is 6 millimeters. That, my friends, is not perspective. Why, to give you a sense of something massive, would they spread it out among something even more massive? I looked up gigaton conversion in other contexts, not much more helpful. So it turns out Greenland is losing ice mass at a rate of 283 gigatons per year. And NASA asks, what's a gigaton? So they have a cool video and they superimpose a gigaton, 1 gigaton of ice over Central Park. And they say it would raise to the height of 341 meters high, which is great, except Central Park's in New York and we don't think in meters. Okay, raise to the height of 1,119 feet high, which is a little less than the size of the Empire State Building. All of ice. Maybe we could get our heads around that. The NASA video also makes the claim that 5,000 gigatons is enough to cover the entire state of Texas with 26 feet of water. I don't know why you'd want to do that. So our gigaton calculation for the amount of water humans extracted during the period coinciding with Friends being on the air was, remember, of 2,150 gigatons. So you do the math. It concludes that amount of water would be enough to cover the entire state of Texas with 11 feet of water, or cover Belgium with 220 feet of water, just because I like to compare things to the size of Belgium. But then I was thinking, wait a minute, humans are water. Humans are more than 50%. Turns out, I think men are maybe 55, women are 60% water. The human biomass is 100 billion tons. Okay, I'm on to something, but then I saw that tons was spelled T-O-N-N-E-S. Ah, Jesus, it's not the regular tons. That tons is a metric ton. 1,000 metric tons is a gigaton. Are you really helping us with any of this, scientists? Anyway, a gigaton is 1 billion metric tons, meaning the amount of water in all people is about 60 billion tons. So 60 gigatons, it means we have, during the Friends years, extracted enough water to water the entire human population 40 times over. If it worked that way, if we were plants, it doesn't work that way. None of this helps. Also, a metric ton just happens to be slightly bigger than a regular ton to be, I don't know, kind of an asshole. The CNN coverage of the paper says, quote, subterranean reserves of liquid water are finite. Once drained, they are slow to replenish, which does not mean finite. It means not finite, just slow, possibly very slow. It gives you some idea of how much any of these people really want us to know or understand, or maybe how much they understand. Here's what I know. The poles have moved 31.5 inches. Interesting, sure. Why? Can't say. I did learn a new word. I'll leave you with something. A zone within the earth that restricts the flow of groundwater from one aquifer to another is called an aquitard. An aquitard. By the way, Dick's Sporting Goods also sells Aquatards alongside the Tankini, but that Aquatard is different from our Aquatard. According to CNN, the size of all Tankinis stacked 13 feet high across the state of Texas would reach a depth of 0.24 inches or about the size of Belgium. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is chief Aquatard purveyor of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oh, and this is kind of weird, but you know I have a Substack. It's called Pesca Profundities. And I wrote about a dog who becomes president. It's fiction, but could happen. I don't know. Just thought I'd give that kind of genre a shot. If you want to check it out, I'd be grateful. Ooperoo-gee-peroo-doo-peroo, and thanks for listening.